KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. If there's one tradition that's never faded away in our history as people on this earth, it's storytelling. StoryCorps is a massive oral history project whose mission is to record, preserve, and share the stories of everyday American people from all kinds of different backgrounds. It was founded in 2003 by radio documentary producer Dave Isay. People are invited to tell their stories in mobile booths all around the country. Selected stories air nationally on NPR. Isay has compiled some of the stories into books. His most recent one is called All There Is, Love Stories from StoryCorps. Isay spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on February 7, 2012. Here, he talks about how StoryCorps began almost 10 years ago.
StoryCorps started in Grand Central Terminal in October of 2003. I had been a radio documentary producer before coming up with this idea. And it's a very, very simple idea. We put a booth in Grand Central Terminal where you can bring anybody who you want to honor by listening to their story. It could be a friend, it could be a grandparent, it could be your partner. You come to the booth and you're met by a facilitator who works for StoryCorps, who brings you inside the booth and closes the door, and you sit across from your, say, your grandmother for 40 minutes, facilitator sitting in the corner, and you listen and you talk. A lot of people think of a StoryCorps interview as, if I had 40 minutes left to live, what would I want to say to this person who means so much to me? Someone was just mentioning, I was at a reception for Town Hall, and someone was talking about tissue, Kleenex. And there's a lot of Kleenex that gets used in a StoryCorps booth. They're often very emotional experiences for people. Facilitators in the corner, at the end of 40 minutes, two CDs have been burned. One goes home with you, and the other stays with us and goes to the Library of Congress, so someday your great-great-great-great-grandkids can get to know your grandmother through her voice and story. Very simple idea. Had no idea what would happen when we opened up this booth. You put a booth in Grand Central Terminal, and you tell people to come in and talk about their lives and don't charge them anything. I had nightmares about, you know, Jerry Springer moments and people punching each other. But 40,000 interviews later with 80,000 people, because most people come in pairs, it's a tribute to the incredible staff of StoryCorps that not one of these interviews has gone wrong. We compiled this new book, All There Is, which I'm really proud of. It's 40 stories out of those 40,000 stories, the most remarkable love stories that we've heard through StoryCorps. And I should say that, you know, we think of every one of the 40,000 stories we've recorded as a sacred moment in people's lives, and they're all equally valuable to us. But some of them have this quality to them that make them appropriate to share with a larger audience. And there are two sides to StoryCorps. One is access to this experience of having this interview. And I think the power of that interview is that sitting with a loved one in this booth and looking them in the eyes and saying, who are you and how do you want to be remembered, lets people know that they matter and that they won't be forgotten. And then we also broadcast pieces on KUOW and write books. And these stories, I hope, for instance, when you listen on KUOW, we do a lot of work to make sure that the full, beautiful breadth of this country is represented in StoryCorps interviews. When we travel the country, half of our interviews are held for people who might not have heard of us through the newspapers or public radio. So we do outreach to all immigrant groups and juvenile justice and homeless groups. And when you hear a story on public radio or read one of these stories, almost by definition, you're going to be listening to someone who is different than you. And hopefully when you hear these stories, and we'll listen to a bunch of them, just for an instant, you'll be walking in the footsteps of someone who you thought was very different than you and recognize a little bit of our shared humanity and all this good stuff that we all believe, and that we should spend more time listening to each other and in this crazy political season, less time shouting at each other and, you know, recognize the value in everybody's story, in everybody's life. And hopefully, we hope someday that StoryCorps will help to move the needle a little bit and make this a better, more thoughtful, compassionate country. So let's listen to some stories, and hopefully you all will agree. And this is, All There is divided into three sections. And, you know, the nature of what happens in a StoryCorps booth, because these are the big life questions that are asked, it's really the great themes of human existence that are talked about in a StoryCorps booth in every interview. So it's family and death and love, which is, of course, the greatest theme of all. This book is about romantic love, and many, many, many interviews touch on romantic love in one way or another. And the book itself is divided into three sections, found, lost, and found at last. So we'll start with found, and I'm going to take you to Brooklyn, if you guys can try and decipher the accents. It's this is a fun story. It's a couple named Honey and Elliot Ryken who came to StoryCorps. Honey is a twin. She has a identical twin sister named Bunny. This is like shooting fish in a barrel, you know. You can't go wrong with this. You can't make this up either. Elliot, twin brother named Danny. So Honey and Elliot and Danny and Bunny meet at the Catskills. They're, Honey and Bunny are waitresses, and Danny and Elliot are musicians, and they fall in love. So Honey marries Elliot, and Bunny marries Danny. Honey and Elliot, they've all been married for 60 years, although Danny passed away. So Honey and Elliot came to StoryCorps to talk about their relationship. And this is Honey and Elliot from Brooklyn.
When we met, you and your sister couldn't tell us apart, and we couldn't tell you two apart.
But by the end of the summer, there was no chance of separating us. And we had a double wedding. You and I were married the same day as Bunny and Danny were married. And it was two brides, two grooms, one set of parents for each. The gowns were identical gowns. The flowers were identical.
We both went on our honeymoon to Miami Beach by different trains.
Yeah, so people
we didn't want it to be so obvious that people would be staring at us. You know,
yeah, the twins that married the twins.
What did you think about marrying me many years ago?
You bowled me over with your way of kissing and the way you hold me when we dance. You're not a fantastic dancer, but you hold me fantastically, and I feel it. It's genuine. You're just not phony. I don't think you have a phony bone in your body. And I never thought anybody lasts this many years.
Like just yesterday, it was our 50th anniversary.
Yeah, now it's 11 years after that.
Yeah.
I never feel, what will he do if I die first? You know how to open tuna fish. You know how to smear it with mayonnaise. You will not fall apart. You'll feel sad when I'm gone, but you'll manage, and that makes me feel very good. Thank you for being you, Elliot. You made my life complete.
And I say the same. You made my life complete, and hope we go on for another 50 years.
I'll take five good ones, and I'll say thank you, God.
Yeah, I think as I listened to that clip, you know, when Honey was telling Elliot that he's genuine, he's just not phony. In a way, that's kind of a clarion call for StoryCorps. And I think part of the power of these stories, you know, it feels sometimes like we're surrounded by so much phoniness. It's hard to tell sometimes what's real and what's an advertisement. You know, you've got all this. I don't watch TV. I have a couple of small kids at home, but I did during Christmas. I went to the gym and I watched TV, and boy, it's terrible. I mean, and these reality shows, I mean, it's channel after channel of pawn shops in Detroit, and it's crazy. But, you know, I think what you have here is people being genuine with each other. And nobody who comes to StoryCorps comes to get rich. Nobody comes to get famous. They come because they love each other and they want to tell each other how much they mean to each other through this process that we've developed. And I think that's part of the power of the stories. People always talk about crying when they hear StoryCorps stories. And I am going to play you some sad ones. I'm not going to spare you tonight. But, you know, many of the stories are not sad at all. And people cry anyway. And I think that's because we're, in many of these stories, you're hearing people being honest with each other. You're hearing everyday people. You're hearing poetry and grace in their voices. And you're hearing often people who are just living life at its fullest and its best. And when you hear that, you're kind of walking on holy ground. And I think that it's the beauty of that that gets people very emotional and talking about Kleenex all the time with StoryCorps. Paul Wilson and Marty Smith came to StoryCorps. And this is, I love this story. This is a very kind of a meat and potatoes, wonderful StoryCorps story that speaks to that poetry and the language. 93-year-old Paul Wilson came to StoryCorps with his daughter, Marty Smith, to talk about meeting her mother in the 1940s. Paul was working at the time at the top floor of an office building in Wichita, Kansas. And Paul and his daughter spoke in Wichita when the StoryCorps booth was there a couple years ago. So this is Paul and Marty Smith.
One day I was waiting in the lobby for the elevator. The door slid aside, and there she stood. The prettiest girl I had ever seen. She was the operator. There were three or four other people on the elevator, and I was the last one on floor number 10. And she opened the door, and I said, "Thank you." And she said, "You're welcome." That was the total conversation, that first contact. Of course, in the next few days, I saw her, but I was so backward and bashful that I didn't say anything to her except, "Tim." She said, "Yes, I know." Thank goodness she broke the ice. She said, "Do you know where you can get some good chop suey? How about that for an opening?" I said, "Sure. The cafe across the street is a Chinese cafe. They serve chop suey."
I sensed that she set that up.
I realized later she did. When I said I eat there every day, she said, "Oh." I realized I had an opening. And we had chop suey, and we got acquainted. We got married right there in my mother's living room, and we had a 63-year honeymoon. And as you often say to me, when we part company, you say, "Life is good." And I have to think, yeah, life is good, even though I've lost my sweetheart.
Who was it that said the best thing a man can do for his children is to love their mother?
I did my best.
You did.
We were real lovers, and every day is a memorial for her.
That was a love story recorded through the National Oral History Project, StoryCorps. Founder Dave Isay spoke about StoryCorps at Seattle's Town Hall on February 7, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Dave Isay in a moment. 819, 94.9 KUOW. The critics are unanimous. They hate the movie God Loves Caviar. Still, Greeks are embracing the film. We'll hear about it later this evening. Also, researchers are recruiting volunteers to nail beaver carcasses to snowy trees to collect wolverine hair. Joe Fontana, mayor of London, Ontario, says he'll stay in office while fighting charges of fraud and breach of trust. And an EU border monitor reacts to the ceasefire and the reopening of Gaza's border with Egypt. All these points tonight at 11. Weather forecast for the Seattle area for tonight, lows around 40, cloudy with a chance of rain this evening, rain likely after midnight. Friday, highs near 50, rain in the morning, showers in the afternoon, rain may be heavy at times in the morning. Friday night, lows lower to mid-40s, showers likely in the evening, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers after midnight. Saturday highs again around 50, cloudy skies, chance of showers.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. What do you wish you could tell your loved ones? What would you say to let them know how much you care? This is the premise of StoryCorps, a national oral history project that encourages people to tell their stories usually in the form of an interview between two people who care about each other. Dave Isay is the founder of StoryCorps, which airs every week on NPR. Isay has compiled some of the stories into books. His most recent one is called All There Is, Love Stories from StoryCorps. Isay spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on February 7th, 2012. He begins this portion of the talk by taking questions from the audience.
When can we see him here? Where can we go to StoryCorps here?
Well, the StoryCorps booths travel across the country. And, I was saying earlier at the reception that I made radio documentaries for many years. And after about a year after seeing The Power of StoryCorps, retired to devote the rest of my life to this thing. And I'm raising money 24 hours a day. So we can't nearly meet the demand for StoryCorps. I was in L.A. a day ago, and someone raised their hand and said, StoryCorps was here a couple months ago, and I called 30 seconds after reservations opened, and I was number 1,500 on the list to get in. So we aren't able to meet demand. We will be back in Seattle at some point soon. We've been here twice, and we have two booths that serve communities all across the country. So keep an eye on our website at storycorps.org.
Because guys, this is a tease otherwise.
What's that?
It's a tease otherwise.
But you know what? The thing is that what I hope people think about and do is, if you can't participate through StoryCorps, do it yourself. Yeah. We have on our website at storycorps.org instructions about how to do these interviews. We can't accept them, and for the Library of Congress, there are very high standards for the audio quality that goes into the Library of Congress and also the data that goes along with the interviews. But, you can get five friends together, put in $10 a piece, and go to a local electronics store and get a digital recorder that is fantastic. And there are instructions on storycorps.org about how to do these conversations. The point is just to do them.
That's great. There's a do-it-yourself. Thank you.
Do-it-yourself. DIY StoryCorps, exactly. Any other questions before I go on? Okay. So I'm going to, I think I'm going to invite Gloria Roberts up to read from the Lost section of this book. One of the best thing about being on tour, and maybe the best thing about this job as a whole, is getting to meet people who have participated in StoryCorps and who show up in these books and whose stories I know so well, and then I get to put a face and a personality. What I always find is that what appears in the book is so true to the person who I end up meeting. And Gloria Roberts tells a fantastic story. I got to spend the morning with her today. She tells a love story about first losing her first husband, who died in a canoeing accident, thinking she'd never marry again. And that's what we see in this. I have to say that this book is as much about love stories as it is, to me, when I read it, it's about hope. Because what you see in these stories over and over again is both serendipity, that it's by chance that these connections happen, and also people who think that they will never find someone ever. At some point, that person sneaks up behind them and taps them on the shoulder, and there is that person for them. So that happened to Gloria. She met a man named Nathaniel Roberts. They both worked at the VA here in Seattle, and fell in love, and they got married in 1997. And then in 2007, Nathaniel was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And I'm going to ask her to read just a short section about being with Nathaniel as his Alzheimer's progressed. Will you come up? Come up on stage, yeah. Are there stairs to get up?
Good evening, everyone. One of the things I'm learning to do is breathe, because this is a challenging time. Nathaniel and I truly love each other very much. He has recently transitioned to a facility for dementia, and it's been real difficult. And before I read this part, just to give you an idea of the love that we have for each other still, even with the Alzheimer's, he knows enough to know that I'm his wife. He don't call me by name. But I was there just a couple of days ago, and he told me how much he loved me. He was kissing my hands, and again, we have this thing where we kiss five times, and that never fails. And so I just wanted to share that. So bear with me as I read this, because this is really a heart-wrenching journey, and I feel it in my gut, but I can read this. He was a ballroom dance instructor And he was a wonderful dancer, very light on his feet. We used to do a lot of the ballroom dances, the waltz, the swing. He doesn't remember the routines anymore, but we still get up to dance. Sometime I'll just put some music on and say, "Come on, let's just dance." And he loves that. He tells me daily how much he loves me, and I truly love him. Whenever we kiss, it's 5 times. And everywhere we go, he lets people know, "This is my wife." When I take him to a doctor's appointment, he also says, "This is my wife, and she's coming in with me. She's my everything." How can you not love that? There are times when I think he's fully present. And then he goes back into this other place. I find myself wanting to argue, but it doesn't do any good. When my first husband passed, I was numb. And I couldn't cry. But I find myself with this one, I cry all the time. It's a different kind of grief. And to me, it's deeper because I see him, but he's not there inside. I can't imagine my future without Nathaniel being in it. But I know that Alzheimer's progresses. So I'm making a decision to stand and to love my husband as he is. That changes all the time, but it's all I can do. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Over the years, StoryCorps launched a series of special initiatives. One of them is called the Memory Loss Initiative, and that's what Gloria participated in, where we work with families who have a loved one. Most of those interviews are with families who have a loved one who's recently been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and give them the chance to have this conversation and leave this interview. We have an initiative called GRIOT, which is a West African word for storyteller, which is now the largest collection of African-American stories ever gathered, Historias, Latino stories. We just launched an initiative called Legacy for families who are in hospice and palliative care. And the first initiative that we ever launched was with the 9/11 Memorial and Museum. Everyone who lost a loved one on September 11th can come to StoryCorps to leave a record of their life. We've had about 1,000 families who have felt like it was time for them to come and leave this record. And many of these stories, of course, are love stories. And I'm gonna play one and I'm gonna read one. First, Beverly Eckert, who lost her husband, Sean Rooney, in the South Tower of the World Trade Center. She recorded her tribute to Sean 5 years after he died, so that would have been 2006. And one of the things we've seen is that families who, most everybody comes to the booth in pairs. When you come by yourself, there are always two facilitators at the booth, one who's helping the next family and the other who's with you. When you come by yourself, both facilitators come in the booth. One runs the equipment and the other asks the questions. And we found that almost all 9/11 families prefer to come in by themselves. So almost all those interviews are singles. And I think it's because the family members are concerned about re-traumatizing other people in their families. But to a person, it's an important experience for them, and I know it was for Beverly Eckert. So this is Beverly remembering her husband, Sean Rooney.
Sean had warm brown eyes and dark curly hair. and he was a good hugger. We met when we were only 16 at a high school dance. And when he died, we were 50. It was about 9:30 a.m. when he called, and he told me he was on the 105th floor, and he'd been trying to find a way out. And he told me that he hadn't had any success, and now the stairwell was full of smoke. I asked if it hurt for him to breathe, and he paused for a moment and then said no. He loved me enough to lie. We stopped talking about escape routes, and then we just began talking about all the happiness we shared during our lives together. I told him that I wanted to be there with him, die with him. But he said no, he wanted me to live a full life. As the smoke got thicker, he just kept whispering, I love you, over and over. I just wanted to crawl through the phone lines to him and hold him one last time. Then I heard a sharp crack, followed by the sound of an avalanche. It was the building beginning to collapse. I called his name into the phone over and over. Then I just sat there, pressing the phone to my heart. I think about that last half hour with Sean all the time. I remember how I didn't want that day to end, terrible as it was. I didn't want to go to sleep, because as long as I was awake, it was still a day that I'd shared with Sean. You know, and he kissed me goodbye before leaving for work. I could still say that was just a little while ago. That was only this morning. And looking back, and all that has happened since he died, and the causes I fought for, and the things I've done, I just think of myself as living life for both of us now. And I like to think that Sean would be proud of me.
So this was Beverly Eckert's memorial to her husband, Sean, and it ended up becoming a memorial to Beverly as well. Beverly died in Continental Flight 3407, which crashed near Buffalo in February of 2009. I'm going to read another 9/11 story, which is a woman named Gran Kestenbaum, who came to StoryCorps to tell the story of the love of her life, Howie Kestenbaum. I love the language in this story, and I hope I can do it justice. Gran Kestenbaum says, Howard and I met on Friday the 13th, 1969. He fell on me at a party, and I thought he was the goofiest guy I'd ever met in my life. He was a student at Columbia working on a PhD in astrophysics, but I didn't believe him. He said he was 25. He didn't look 25. He had a shirt that was so rumpled, and he had these old stovepipe jeans and a pair of shoes, one of which had many, 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 many rubber bands wrapped around it because his soul was coming apart. When I was going to leave the party, he said, I'll walk you home. And I thought, what did I do to deserve this? I don't want you to walk me home. And so he walked my friend and I home. I lived at the time in a girl's residence on West 11th Street in the Village, and my friend and I stayed up and talked about what a goofball he was. Some weeks later, he called me and said, hello, this is Howie. And I said, Howie who? And he said, fine, thank you, Howie you. And then she goes on to tell more stories about Howie trying to woo her and waiting outside the apartment for her, and she says at one point he got some helium balloons and he floated them up. I was on the second or third floor and they said, Gran, please come out. The girls thought that was wonderful, but I was embarrassed to death. I thought, this guy is really crazy. Finally, the lady who was in charge of the residence said, you've got to get that guy out of here. She said, give him a date, for God's sake, get it over with. So I went out and I said, I'll date you someday. He said, no, you'll forget me. You've got to date me now. So he said, dinner. I said, oh, no, I'm not dating you for dinner. I said, how about lunch? He came on Saturday for lunch, and we went to Washington Square Park. He had a package of Crystal Mint Lifesavers and some seltzer, and he split the Lifesavers in half, and he drank half the seltzer, and then he handed me the can. But the next year, in June of 1970, we were married. And then for 31 years, we were together. Howard Kestenbaum was also in Tower 2 of the World Trade Center on the morning of September 11, 2001. And this is from the end of Grant's story. People talk about closure. There is no closure when you lose a loved one. I don't care how you lost them. Your heart is always open. Edna St. Vincent Millay wrote something that affected me. It says, "Where you used to be, there's a hole in the world, which I find myself constantly walking around in the daytime and falling in at night. I miss you like hell. I miss him like hell." The last section in All There is called Found at Last. And I'm going to just play a couple of short excerpts of stories from that section. The first one is a story of a man named David Wilson, who came to StoryCorps to tell his love story. It's an incredible story. He's African-American and was married, realized he was gay. He and his wife split up, and he got into a relationship with a man named Ron Loso, who was a white man. They lived in the suburbs of Boston in a white neighborhood, and he tells the story of coming home one day, and Ron was raking the leaves, and he died of a heart attack raking the leaves, and David ran out to care for him, and the cops came and the ambulance came, and they tried to arrest him because they thought that he was assaulting his partner. And of course, when they cleared that up, when he got to the hospital, he wasn't allowed to be with Ron as he was pronounced dead. And then David also thought he wouldn't fall in love again, but he was in a bereavement support group, and he met a man named Rob Compton, and they fell in love, and they're still together. And he tells the story, and I'll play a little audio of this, with Rob being the lead plaintiffs in the case that legalized gay marriage in Massachusetts. And this is an excerpt of David talking about his family's reaction to that.
Part of the decision to be part of the case was to talk with my family. My dad wasn't sure. All of a sudden, his only son is going to become this prominent, out, gay, black man. So I talked with Dad about some of the issues. A couple hours later, Dad said, "You're doing the right thing." May 17th, 2004 was the first weddings. Dad said, "Well, you're going to City Hall and you're going to be part of all of this excitement. What about me?" I said, "Dad, I'm sending a limo to pick you up." My dad had never been in a limo. He got a new suit, came down, and limo took him down, and he was in the front row, and when we walked down the aisle, both his arms were in the air. He was 89 at that point. And he didn't see it just for gay people. He saw it for, you know, all people that had been discriminated against. In his whole life, he had been discriminated against. So I think for Dad, it was just a victory that he could be a part of. He could not have been more proud. It was a great day.
I'm going to play one more audio story. And this is also from Found at Last. And I've never played this. This is a story that aired last week on NPR. And I remember reading the transcript of this in a hotel lobby and just not believing how this story unfolded. It's the most epic courtship that I have ever heard of. And the book goes into more depth about this, but I think the audio is pretty wonderful also. This is a story of a love that's a little bit longer than what we've been listening to. It's a man named Thomas Peter Hayden, and the love of his life, whose name is Jackie. It's a love story of just unbelievable near misses that spans one war, three continents, and four decades. It begins at a roller skating rink inside the Indian Head Naval Base in Central Maryland. And I think they say their ages. I think Thomas might have been 16 and Jackie might have been 15. And if you'll bear with this story, it's a little bit longer. But this is their just a piece of their love story.
I was there one night, and I saw this young lady skating around, and I waited for her to take a break and go get a Coke before I made my move.
He just grabbed my hand and rolled me around and said, "I'm Peter Hayden. Who are you?"
And she says, "My name's Jacqueline Lefevre." And I looked in those big green eyes, and I was a done deal.
From there, we started dating.
And in 1959, her father got transferred to Japan. So I decided, well, I'll go to Japan and get her. So I went and joined the Marine Corps and said, "Well, I want to go to Japan." The Marine Corps said, "Oh, you'll go to Japan when we tell you you can go to Japan." And I was home on leave and stopped by to see Jacqueline's mother. She said right away, "Jackie got married."
I just got married for all the wrong reasons, and I was very unhappy.
I carried a picture of Jackie in my pack for 3 years in Vietnam. We'd have a hard day. I'd just pull a picture out and say, "I guess that's why I'm doing this." So I wrote her a letter, told her how I felt.
I don't know how the letter found me. It had all these forewords stamped all over the envelope. And he said, "I love you. I've always loved you. I just have to get this off my chest, and I'm done."
I did my tour, and I came back from Vietnam. I spent 24 hours at home. And I went into my mother about 4 o'clock in the morning. I said, "I got to go to North Carolina to see Jackie." And she kind of looked at me and she said, "I think you better leave that one alone. But I guess you got to do what you have to do."
And I sent him away. I came from a divorced family and didn't want my kids to have a broken home. And my husband's a very domineering, controlling person. If I left, he wouldn't let me have my children.
She said, "You know, I'm not going to see you anymore." That was September 25th, 1968. And I didn't hear from you again until September 25th, 1998.
I had tried to call him off and on over the years, and I'd always call the operator and say, "Do you have a T.P. Hayden?" And she'd say, "No." And then in 98, I had made up my mind, I am just out of here. I'm so miserable. I'm so unhappy. So I said, "Well, nobody ever loved me but Peter. I'm going to go see if I can find him one more time." And the operator said, "I've got a T.P. Hayden in White Plains." Then I said, "Oh, my God, that's him." I said, "I have been trying to find this person for 30 years. It's the love of my life." She said, "Do you want me to dial a number for you?" I said, "Yeah, you can dial a number." She said, "Can I stay on the line?" I said, "I don't care what you do."
And the phone rang. And she said, "Do you know who this is?" I said, "Yeah, I know exactly who this is." She said, "I bet you're mad at me." I said, "No, matter of fact, I'm still in love with you." It's just sad, the time we lost, but I got her back, so I won, you know? And she's just as beautiful as she was when she's 15.
That was one of the love stories recorded through the National Oral History Project, StoryCorps. Founder Dave Isay spoke about StoryCorps at Seattle's Town Hall on February 7th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Dave Isay in a moment. 844 94.9 KUOW. At this point in the 21st century, it's kind of impossible to talk about community building without at some point talking about the internet. The way we meet people, establish connections, maintain our relationships, and fight for what we believe in has been radically transformed by the web, and it's still transforming. But often when we're talking about these changes, the focus is either on pure enthusiasm about the possibilities presented by the limitlessness of the web or anxiety about online connections replacing physical ones. Tomorrow morning, we're going to hear stories of the internet's impact on community building in human terms, on the messy level of people's daily existence, where its effects are rarely solely positive or negative. In each of the stories, we're going to look at a different way the internet slipped into our interactions with one another, including wholesale social transformations facilitated by the web, individual lives reconfigured, and more minor everyday happenings, an hour of exploring how the virtual has turned into the real in people's lives. Spooky. That's tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, a special program. Lows around 40 tonight, cloudy with a chance of rain this evening. Rain likely after midnight. Friday highs near 50, rain in the morning, heavy at times, showers in the afternoon. President Lincoln and his Emancipation Proclamation from 150 years ago. How should we look at it in the long term, politically, militarily, morally? That's at 9 o'clock.
From 94.9 KUOW Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. StoryCorps is a massive oral history project whose mission is to record, preserve, and share the stories of everyday American people from all kinds of different backgrounds. It was founded by radio producer Dave Isay in 2003. Here's how it works. Usually two people who have some sort of relationship go into a booth. There, a facilitator records an interview between them. They can talk about anything. Love, loss, life. Isay has compiled some of the stories into books, and his most recent one is called All There Is, Love Stories from StoryCorps. Isay spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on February 7, 2012. In this portion of his talk, he continues taking questions from the audience. The first question is, how do the facilitators keep it together when recording emotional interviews?
Well, the reason why they can't serve more than 3 years is because it's a very high burnout job. They're professionals. They're hired because they're great listeners, and they do a really magnificent job of making these interviews work. We give them counseling when they need it, and there are a lot of difficult interviews, and we do our best to take care of them. And I think they see it as a sacred trust with the people who are in the booth. And I think that generally they feel like it's not about them, so they're there to be present for the people who are in the booth and have great discipline to kind of keep it together and make sure that the people in the booth have the best experience they possibly can. It is an amazing job that the facilitators do. And I think of, I was saying before that the book is about hope, and in many ways I think StoryCorps is a very hopeful project. And the message that we've had more than 100 facilitators serve, I should count. I mean, I think it's probably getting close to 200 facilitators who've served for StoryCorps since we started 8 years ago. And to a person, when you ask them when they get off the road what they've learned, the first thing that all of them will say is that people are basically good. It may be a self-selecting crowd that comes to StoryCorps to some extent, but we get a real, real wide range of people who come into the booth. The other thing that they'll all say is that if you think you can judge someone's inner life by the way they look or the way they dress, you're always, always, always going to be wrong. Other questions? Yes. The question was, how is StoryCorps funded? We are a very lean, mean institution. We get money from a bunch of different sources. One of the biggest sources of funding, about 25% of our funding, comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, which, as you all know, is which is the entity that funds public broadcasting and is very likely to be defunded at some point in the near future, which would be a terrible hit for StoryCorps. I mean, I see public broadcasting as as a part of what makes this country great. I mean, it's like a national parks or libraries, that this is what a civil society is all about. So I hope folks, when the fight gets really rough over public broadcasting, we can use all of your voices to rise up and say that public broadcasting is important. And if there was no CPB, there wouldn't be a StoryCorps. We get corporate funding. All the big foundations fund us, but because what we're doing is so weird, we don't fit into any foundation guidelines, so it's all discretionary funding. And everyone who participates in StoryCorps becomes an alumna, so that is a form of revenue for us as well. And we also have a business where if you're a library in Kansas and you want 2 days of StoryCorps, you can buy that from us, and we sell it for a little bit above what it costs us. So that's how StoryCorps survives. But we have a long way to go. The dream is to, as I said, create this sustaining national institution. And I don't think we're at the first pitch of the first inning of a very long game before we really get to kind of have the impact that I hope this is going to have on the country. Any other questions?
I have a question.
Yes. Oh,
hi.
Brave.
I'm a town hall native, if you will. So, I don't know if you know, but there's StoryCorps Legacy going on in Seattle right now.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Bailey Boucher House. Yeah, and it's great.
Are any facilitators here? No. Okay.
No. I invited them, but I work there. So
great.
I was wondering if you have any other of those special themed ones planned, or what your goals are for that type, where you leave the equipment and teach people, and it goes for a couple months.
So the legacy is a new model for StoryCorps. And Legacy is the hospice and palliative care project that we've launched. And it's because of the nature of folks who are in hospice or palliative care, the idea of doing an interview at a given hour doesn't necessarily work. People may get tired. That hour may not be the right hour for them to do it. So what we're doing is training volunteers and people who work in the hospice, doctors and other caregivers, to be the facilitators in the interview, and we're testing that out to see how that can work, and we're excited about the service that we're offering, and as far as changing the service model, another thing we're thinking about. I'm a big fan of public libraries, and we're thinking about figuring out a way to have volunteers and people who work in public libraries be facilitators and set up booths in public libraries, again, in a way to try and deliver more service to more people. Yes?
How did you make that first pitch to the Central Grants Association, and
How did I get the booth in Grand Central Station? I'm like a junkyard dog. Like, I just would not let up until they let me put the booth in Grand Central Station. And, StoryCorps, when it started, we were four people, and we're now about 120 people. I was able to get some initial funding, and then we came within, about after 3 months being open, we came within 2 weeks of having to close the whole thing down. And, serendipity, I guess, also has played a role in StoryCorps. A couple of kind of angels stepped in and gave us money so that we could get through another couple of months, and then we were able to build from there. So, I think, StoryCorps is something that all of us who work there believe in with every cell in our body, and we just get up and, it's very difficult. It is hard work, but we believe in this, and we just fight it every day. And we'll see. I'm gonna come back to you, but I'm gonna take a question from over here.
Are all the interviews excerpted into the 2 to 3 minute sections for the website or radio? And if not, how do you select which ones are?
So the question is, are all the interviews on the website, are they excerpted? And if not, how do you select which ones are? The answer, absolutely not. No, we probably excerpt one out of every 500 interviews. And as I said earlier, all of them are equally valuable, but these have that the kind of poetry that might speak to a larger audience. The facilitators in the booth play many roles. They make people comfortable. They run the equipment. They ask questions if you want them to ask questions. They don't if you don't. And they also keep a log of the interview and make a mark whether an interview might be appropriate for broadcast or might be appropriate for a book. And those are two separate questions. So on the audio side, the facilitators pick two or three of their favorite interviews a week, and they'll make a long kind of rough cut of that and then send it to the production team in New York. And that team winnows it down, and then out of those interviews, the one that ends up on NPR every week is chosen. So we probably have... We've been on the air for 5 years, so we probably have 250 interviews on the web. And you can go to the Library of Congress to listen to all of the interviews. And at some point, probably around our 10th anniversary, I hope, we'll make the archive public. And it'll be a highly searchable archive, so people can listen to the full interviews and search within the interviews. Other questions?
You've spoken several times about these wonderful people who are doing the facilitating.
Yes.
Have you ever recorded any of those stories?
That's a great question. I hope at some point, the question is, have we ever, I don't have to repeat it. It's in the mic. I'm a radio person. I should know that. The facilitators, when they finish their tour of duty, what they do as part of their exit is to do an interview, a StoryCorps interview about what they've done over the years as a facilitator. And I hope someday, at some point, to write a book that's based on the stories of the facilitators who've served for StoryCorps. So that's a great question. Thank you. Gloria, did you have a question? Yeah. Come.
One of the things I just wanted to address is I remember the person who interviewed me was so gracious, and having worked myself in mental health for several years, I know it's important to separate my story and my stuff from what I'm hearing. I thought the interviewer did a wonderful job, and she was so gracious, and she didn't feel bad about crying herself when there were moments about crying. One of the things about my story now, because my currently it's changed quite a bit, I'm wondering if you do any follow-ups, like a part two.
Yeah. You know, again, we are resource-strained, and we have a hard time meeting demand, but we do our best. So we would love to come back and have you record another story. And especially now that you're a big VIP and the star of the book. So, absolutely, we'd love to have you record again. Again, we're here, and you know, I was thinking there's the woman who spoke from the hospice. There's one of the people who was someone who worked very closely with us on creating the Legacy Initiative. There's a guy named Ira Byock, who's a great hospice doctor at Dartmouth Hitchcock, and you know what he always says to his team is, you know, it's not about you. And I think that that's very much kind of the spirit of the facilitators. Yes, they'll cry, they'll be there to support you, but it really is about the participants. It's not about the facilitators, and they're there to serve. And again, you know, public broadcasting is public service. I mean, many of us are involved in public service of one kind or another, and we think of this that way. I'm very grateful to everyone for coming out tonight. I do think of this, as I said, as the beginning, the nucleus of, I hope, a movement about authenticity and listening, and you know, the real American story, the courage and grace and kindness in people when we take the time to really look for it. And I hope you'll join us at the beginning of this mission and spread the word about StoryCorps. I hope you will take the time, if you can't do it through StoryCorps, to do these interviews yourself. It gets back to, you know, there's I've been thinking a lot because we're just launching this hospice program, and there's this tradition in hospice of five things you want to say to someone before they die. And I hope I can remember it. Thank you. I love you. Forgive me. I'm sorry. And goodbye. And what I hope that one of the things I hope is that StoryCorps reminds us to say the things to the people that that matter to us today, and not to wait, because as we heard in so many of these stories, life can be so fleeting, and you really want to take the time to let people know what they mean to you. So thank you all for coming out tonight.
Dave Isay, radio producer and founder of StoryCorps, the National Oral History Project. Isay spoke at Seattle's Town Hall on February 7th, 2012. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Puget Sound Energy, with a reminder that Energy Star refrigerators and freezers use less energy but have all the same features as standard models. More information is available at pse.com/appliances. 859 KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Nearly 2 years after the revolutions of the Arab world, have new governments been able to fulfill the desires of the young protesters who overthrew governments in much of the region? A journey through Lebanon, Egypt, Morocco, and Tunisia to understand the desires and needs of young Arabs. A special program tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Today's KUOW Day sponsors are Linda and Eric Anderson, wishing the Foyt family a happy Thanksgiving, and Tim and Charlene Forsland, in gratitude for friends and family, especially their children, Noah and Sarah. KUOW is a self-sustaining service of the University of Washington, thanks to the generosity of contributing listeners. If you are a member, thank you. If not, you can always become one at KUOW.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.